portends for the future of relations between the peoples of this world. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and the former Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Among his books is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much.
Chris, in a recent writing of yours, you claim that Gaza's present situation was foretold long ago. You also recently interviewed Amy Kaplan, author of Our American Israel, The Story of Entangled Alliance. So talk to us about this notion, your contention, really, that Gaza's history was long ago foretold.
Well, you know, I spent 7 years in the Middle East and much of that time in Gaza, covering the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the antecedents of the current genocide have long been part of Israel's essentially DNA. In 1948, a series of massacres and the displacement of roughly 750,000 Palestinians. And then in the 1967 war, another 350,000 Palestinians were displaced. But in between those conflicts and after that, there was a kind of slow-motion ethnic cleansing, which I covered. With the rise of Netanyahu, his father was a member of the Herut Party. The Herut Party came out of the Zionist terrorist groups, the Irgun and others, and always called for...
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
To all of our Is Sound a Language listeners, this is Ashley.
This is Logan.
Today we have a very special guest. We have Petra Floyd. They are a CMU School of Art MFA alumni and multidisciplinary visual and sound artist based in Pittsburgh, PA. We're super excited to be chatting with them this evening. How are you doing, Petra?
I'm okay. I feel like strangely nervous. I was like, wow, I feel like I'm interviewing for grad school again or something. Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I feel good.
Amazing. So I wanted to start with a question that you gave us, actually, which is, what is your relationship to hearing and listening as a sense?
Yeah. When I wrote that question, I was thinking about how I'm drawn to working with sound because I have such a strong response to it. I'm someone who has like different sensory issues, something I didn't become more aware of until my adulthood. And so like hearing a slight buzz or things like that, right, would be affecting me emotionally, but I wouldn't know why. I'd be like a little annoyed or a little irritated or something, right? And then I found the word misophonia. And I forget what miso means in that, but phonio, as we know, it's like sound. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, things like someone chewing or having like a, not being able to clear their throat all the way, or honestly, just not liking the sound of someone's voice. And be like, I wish I could change that. So that's a way that I became more aware of my relationship to sound as a sense. And I also do some grounding exercises, and you've probably heard this grounding exercise, the like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, where it's like, name 5 things that you see, 4 things that you can touch, you know, things like that. And I was finding that that was helpful for me, because as someone who like doesn't drive, for example, I'd be like on the bus or the trolley in Philly, and it'd be like, man, I'm just so agitated and irritated on my commute to work. Like, why am I so angry? Like, yeah, work is hard, but like, this is just extra. And I realized it's because I couldn't control what was happening, like sonically for me. Even when you put in headphones, like someone's talking loud, you can hear the groan of the bus, like these different things. I'm talking about how sound, you know, can be a source of like concern for me, but also it's been a great comfort for me. And I would say that listening to a good like DJ set or sound podcast or something, and going for a walk when I felt like my loneliness here in Pittsburgh as like a transplant, was something that just refreshed my imagination, my outlook on life. And also there have been moments for me where sound has been transformative, and I have just been like a weepy mess after like listening to something really good, you know? So those are some of the things that come to mind for me when thinking about sound as a sense and its impact on me.
And I guess to jump off about your relationship with sound and as a sense, do you consider sound a language?
Yeah, I was so curious about the name of this class and the name of this like podcast, because yeah, there's like lots of different languages. Not all of them are sonic, of course, like written language or like pictorial language. I think sound can be a language. When I think about a language, I think about like a coherent system of some sort that like you can refer to, even if it's just a language of your own, but you can refer back to it after the fact and there still be like a stable enough meaning, you know, that you're calling back to. So yeah, sound can be a language. It kind of feels silly to like be like, can sound be a language when we're literally speaking right now?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking like, I think about the patterns of life, like waiting at the bus stop, hearing the cars whiz by, hearing 2 blocks away the sound of the bus beeping, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the bus comes, the doors open, it lowers, you know? There's a beep of me tapping my car. That's a predictable pattern that communicates that I'm on some type of journey. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, it reminds me of when, I don't know if you had this experience as a kid, but whenever you're making like an imaginary language or something, and there has to be someone else to exchange it with and have a kind of call and response, like the bus in a way becomes that. So you're an artist who makes sound, improvisational sound, improvisational performance. How important to you is the act of improvisation, and does it have to be recorded? Does it have to have a life outside of that moment? Or is the kind of special quality of it that it's ephemeral and lives on in those that participated in it?
I mean, I think there can be benefits to recording and also not recording. For example, I went to an improv set last night. There's this really wonderful group called Pittsburgh Sound Preserve. They've run an open improv lab, which has been a really important space for me where, as the name suggests, we improvise. And it's kind of random who you end up improvising with, although there's like a cast of recurring characters, which I'm glad to become one. And I, in the past, have taken out my phone to record, where I'm like, ooh, this moment is really hitting. Like, I need to capture it, maybe because my partner is in a particular improv group and I want them to hear back what happens, you know? And in that type of setting, it can be nice to record, because sometimes when you're really like catching the spirit and you're just sort of riding the wave, right? Because you're really plugged in, you're listening to the audience and your collaborators. So it's nice to have something to be like, oh yes, that moment happened. Yeah. Because sometimes I improv with people and I forget who I even improv with. They'll be like, yeah, that was great. And I was like, So it's nice to have the document in that kind of way for an open improv like that. But last night I just was like, I don't want to record. I want to just be in the moment, you know? Also, I will say though, it depends on your goals, right? If you want a type of score for yourself to refer back to because you're creating a work or something, then that's great. You can use it to sample, bring it into the next improvisation. But I don't necessarily always have the patience to like go back and listen to the recording.
So a few weeks ago, we did an exercise where we thought of either like the first song that we could remember and tried to like locate where it takes us. And so we're curious if there's a sound or a piece of music that you can recall and like where it takes you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many songs that do that for me, that sent me into a specific place. I will say that there's this one DJ producer named African Sciences. And it's African spelled with a K. And he has this one mix. It's called, he did it for Berlin Community Radio, I believe. And the mix is called Satellite Editions
1.
And well, let's say I took a bath and it was an enhanced bath. And I was listening to, you know, this set before. It helped inspire some artwork I made. It helped me work through a problem I had. And then for this enhanced bath, I was listening to it and I connected with my ancestors. And they had some important things to tell me about myself. That musical space that African Sciences constructed for me, when I listen back to it, it's an opportunity to return back to those lessons, that self-knowledge discovered in those moments. I offer that to y'all if you want to listen to something really groovy and good. I will say that sometimes being a person, there's so many different parts of you that you become alienated from or are influenced to think are separate and discrete. And when you're in the practice of making sense of yourself, like in grad school, and presenting that to other people, there's lots of self-editing that happens for me before I even knew it. And something like an African Sciences set is like, no, all of those things, no matter how disparate they seem, even they don't fit neatly into the outline or the brainstorming map or whatever. Like, this is like the universe of you. These are, you know, these are the various constellations that inform you. And they can all be in the same place. So really impactful music does that for me.
Amazing. Wow. I think talking about graduate school and that experience, a few of us in the program have had a lot of conversations about play and what play means. And we get told to play more in this space. And for some, play is a space of orientation and disorientation, and play requires a kind of safety. So in those kind of confines, what is your relationship to play? And do you see improvisation as play?
Okay, I'm going to need to take that piece by piece.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, let's start off.
We can break it down.
Yeah, let's break it down. Let's start off with the first piece, please.
What is your relationship to play?
All right.
See? Easy.
Yeah, easy. Who hasn't played? Yeah, my relationship with play,
And did people tell you that during graduate school?
You should play more?
Or, yeah.
I don't recall. Maybe they did.
You've blocked it out at this point. Yeah.
There's a lot that's like deep within me now. But yeah, I came in interested in play, and imaginative play has been important to me. And then as a young adult, moving in various worlds and methodologies of making art, it was hard for me to think of myself as like a fine artist, but I was drawn to people who were doing things with performance, mm-hmm. and like improvised, devised performance. And we had this play language with each other, because as adults, play becomes either discouraged or it needs to be organized, right? You go to the axe throwing place, you buy the video game, but just open-ended imaginative play is something that's very much alive in theatrical spaces, I would say. Yeah. And being in those play spaces helped me realize I still had that intelligence about me. Mm-hmm. Because, I'm a neurodivergent person, and one of the things that separates you from the more typical kids or the kids who are masking more is they drop emotional play or imaginative play faster. Mm-hmm. So, like, I remember middle school being a little freak with my friends, running around, little weirdo squad. I had crushes on my classmates and all the quote-unquote age-appropriate things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I wanted to run around and eat weeds and...
Yeah.
Just get worked up and whatever. Mm-hmm. And that same spirit was present in these devised, improvised theatrical spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's where I realized that I had my own sensibility, that I had my own intelligence, that I had certain aesthetics I was after. I would go see shows, especially like scratch nights. The idea of a scratch night is works in progress. You present, you just throw up what you have and you get feedback from the audience. Mm-hmm. And seeing other people play in that way was so exhilarating to me and encouraged me to make my own work. I'm no longer primarily interested in like long form performance or anything like that, but it was a pace of play that was important for me.
Yeah. For you, in your opinion, where does the performance begin and end in play?
Wow. This makes me think about why like TikTok videos are so great. By great, I mean like so impactful for people, because like we're watching other people play and some of us take on that invitation to play. Yes, I'm going to do that dance with my friends, or I'm going to try this challenge, or I'm going to try this recipe or whatever. But we're kind of like the kids on the sidelines being like, oh, I want to do that too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there may be those folks who are sort of standing on the sideline who are like, oh, I want to do that too. You know? Mm-hmm. And like, you may or may not be performing for them. And the question of what performance is just like another can of worms in itself, which is not to say it's like a bad question to ask. But this reminds me of the idea of a performance ending when no one remembers it anymore. Mm. But you asked about when a performance starts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So when does the performance start? That I can't answer. I can't answer.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's honesty too. I appreciate
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So one of the readings you shared with us was a Miri Baraka's poem, Rhythm Travel. Baraka describes rhythm travel as a way to move through time via sound. As a sonic artist, do you see parallels between this idea and your own work?
Oh, totally. And I didn't learn about the Baraka poem until pretty recently, like just last year. It's a really good podcast by the artist Santa Gold. And I wish I remember the title. She's in this conversation about Afrofuturism, actually. Mm-hmm. And one of her guests brings up Amiri Baraka's piece, which is how I found out about it. I love the time travel capacities of sound. And also, like, we talked about play and safety earlier. So, you know, there are so many times when, like, I've shared a particular, we'll say, musical experience with someone, and I'm no longer in relation to that person. Like, we broke up, our friendship petered off, or we're just in different places. And listening to that song helps me safely encounter them in that relationship again, you know? It helps you, like, travel within yourself. You know, it's like a costume you can put on. You can either be singing it or just be like, this is the vibe I'm moving in right now, you know? So it's a way to alter your present. Yeah, and like what I said earlier about that African sciences mix, it takes me to these different places, musicians that I will never meet, right? But one of my favorite things too is like listening to an artist that I had no idea about before. For example, Shuggy Otis. And being like, oh, he's like old school Steve Lacy. Like, and being like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, seeing the lineage.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. Lineage. I think that's one thing that's been so important for me. I will say that being in this type of educational institution, there's an expectation of an awareness of your artistic lineage, right? Mm-hmm. Who are the people you're calling in through your practice, right? And part of that work hinges upon who you've been introduced to, you know, like who have you been taught, right? And I will say that as a Black artist here in America, most of my educators were white. I can count on one hand, like the Black educators that I had in formal educational contexts. And so learning about my lineages as an artist has required like some active digging and learning myself, like going out and fetching it. When I have been in sound spaces where we talk about sound lineages, like, oh, who sampled whom? And this beat was actually established in this way by these people over here. And then it got sampled by somebody else. And I was like, what a great way to teach history, right? Through songs, right? A lineage of songs. What a great way to bring in different concepts. There's a really wonderful educator and DJ, Susie Analog. And she gives a fabulous lecture about the African roots of contemporary American music and the idea of like looping and sampling as related to the Bokongo cosmogram, which shows a relationship between the life on earth, the heavens, and the underworld. And she's like, yeah, this call and response, repetition, you can track this throughout these different musical movements. And just hearing Susie talk about these things made me feel so grounded in my creative endeavors in a way where I felt connected to deep time. Not just like, oh, my dad was a musician and therefore I'm interested in sound, but like deep, deep time, you know?
Yeah,
that's the time travel that has been really important for me.
That kind of leads into this next question of, the concept of rhythm travel implies that sound is not just heard, but felt and embodied. And so either in your music listening experience or in your performances, how do you engage with the physicality of sound?
Yeah, let's talk about it. So much of my work right now is figuring it out and making that happen, like making situations where that can happen. So I could talk about my project Audiobolisk. Audiobolisk is a sonic response I've had and have invited other people to join me in, where we're responding to this sculpture by a Pittsburgh artist, Peter Calaboyas. He passed away a few years ago, and he made this piece that's five obelisks, metal obelisks. They're situated in Mellon Park on Penn Ave, right near East Liberty. If you're a curious onlooker and you just like tap the sculpture, each of these obelisks resonates so beautifully, right? So they have a voice in their own. For Audiobolisk, what happens is that I, on a whim and a hunch, I was like, I think these can be resonated with transducers. Tactile transducers, if you think about like a video game, I don't know, something might be happening on screen, dramatic, and then your like controller starts to rumble, you know what I mean? It's a sort of similar thing where like it's taking that like sonic information and translating it back into vibration. And those vibrations can be used to like rattle your seat or your video game controller, or they can rattle a surface and reproduce the original sound. And so I like learned about that while here in grad school from a really amazing professor, Annie Shea. And I was like, I think I can take this, attach them to this sculpture, and I just want to hear my voice through this sculpture. Mm-hmm. And I tried it out, and it was so freaky and so cool to feel the sculpture rattle with my voice, right? And then I got to invite other folks to do the same. And we did, you know, improvisations to try out the possibility space, right? Like, what's the possibility space here? What are all the things we can do that are non-damaging, you know, to this sculpture and vibrating it? A couple of these what I call sounding events. Folks from Pittsburgh Sound Preserve have come through, folks from my CMU community, other people I've met around Pittsburgh have come through to participate. And the second time we did this, which was in October, I took the time to actually like hold one of these obelisks while it was being vibrated. And I had never experienced sound like that before, just like going through my body. And even subtle sounds too, not like a sonorous roar or anything, but scratching a microphone with their like stuffed animal, the little hand of the stuffed animal rubbing a microphone, I could feel throughout my body. It's like incredible. I'm interested in that, yeah, that experiential play there.
I had a question about the transducers and these contract microphones that are in direct connection with the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, like, the sounds we hear are received as vibrations sent through the air. Do you consider that direct contact with the sculpture that you were describing as like a hyper-hearing or a hyper-sensitivity towards sound?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think of like a hierarchy in like sonic experience or anything. I think there's just a bouquet of possibilities.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about like the sound of my iPad playing back a podcast or a TV show while I'm in the bath, and I listen to it while I'm above water, and then I dunk my head and submerge my body in, and I'm hearing this sort of different experience, right? Of the sound. It's like distant, it's in my head differently. I'm just sort of hungry for those different experiences. Yeah. I'm like omnivorous in that kind of way. One could certainly think of it as a type of hyper-hearing. And I would say you know, you could get really specific there, right? What aspect of the sound are you isolating or drawing attention to? But so much of it is tied into perception as well, right? Because you could go to a chamber meters below the earth where it's super quiet and you'll hear your voice in a way you probably have never heard before. You know, that could be a type of hyper hearing, as you're saying. Or you could be in a weird cave and hear your voice echo in a strange way, right?
Yeah.
It's about like the physical phenomenon of like the how the sound is happening, but also just what level of attention are you able to have to it to sort of filter or let in something different, you know?
Yeah, there's a sort of attunement that comes with ways of hearing and listening. And we're not a bat. We're not a fish. There's so many different ways that other creatures are hearing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, I mean, it's a very rich field. There's so much to study and learn within it. I'm no expert on anything, but I'd recommend reading the book An Immense World by Ed Yong. And that's where he discusses animal senses. And he's such a great narrator. He's a really great science communicator. And so the way he's able to create a bridge between our understanding of the world and the possibility really of understanding an animal's experience of the world has been really like informative for me. So yeah, I would recommend reading that if you really want to like get into the weeds with understanding how different beings perceive sounds. Yeah.
I kind of like what you said, how different beings perceive.
You're fierce. You take care of business and don't hold back. Taking care of your health shouldn't be any different. You know when something's off. Don't ignore symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and rashes. Listen to your body. It could be lupus. We're here to help you take control. Learn how at BeFiercetakeControl.org. Brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
Books in a dying tree. still believe through the shame and through the grief, through the heartache, through the tears, through the waiting, through the years, for people like us in places like this. We need all the hope.
time.